serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with Paul John Roach, Minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here's your host, Paul John Roach.
Well, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity.fm. Unity Online Internet Radio Network. It goes out to 120 countries worldwide. And our show, as the introduction said, focuses on the commonalities, but also the amazing diversity of the world's faith traditions. And I am actually on location in Annapolis right now, which is exciting. It's a beautiful day here, away from Texas for this week. And this week we welcome back to the show a person who was on a little while ago, to discuss his new book, The Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. There's a whole wealth of information in this book. And so we're revisiting some of the ideas and especially how pertinent many of them are in our current economy, our current consciousness here in America and around the world. The author is a neuropsychologist and meditation teacher, a summa cum laude graduate of the University of California in Los Angeles. He co-founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and edits the Wise Brain Bulletin. And so it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the show Rick Hansen, PhD. I'm just going to call him Rick from now on. So welcome, Rick.
Hi, John, and thanks for calling me Rick. Otherwise, I'd have to call you Reverend Roach or something.
Yeah, no, just call me Paul. I got so many names, Paul, John, Roach, whatever, but just call me Paul.
Okay,
you know, a lot of the book is talks about mindfulness and awareness and attention as being sort of antidotes to the stress that we all feel. And, you know, there's stress around in all of life, but it seems particularly so today, doesn't it, with the debt ceiling, acts of terrorism throughout the world, even in peaceful places like Norway. This show is going out end of July 2011, and we're filled with these things. Many people are talking about 2012 and the shift that's about to take place there. There's uncertainty. Your book addresses that, yes?
Well, I think so, and it does, because for me it's important, just as you say, to recognize the real world on the one hand, and obviously as well to do what we can out there in the world, whether it's at the scale of global institutions or more locally at home, doing what we can out in the world, like getting a stop sign put in at the end of the street so kids can cross safely to school. But that said, changing the world usually comes pretty slowly, and if at all. And meanwhile, what are we going to do? There's a traditional saying in Tibet that the world is covered with thorns and sharp stones. What are you going to do? You can either cover the world with leather or you can put on a pair of shoes.
Right.
And, I'm a big believer in the power of practice and putting on a pair of shoes and enhancing your shoes and growing some leather and so forth. And therefore, I'm very interested in what we can all do inside our own minds based on neuroscience.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it was Ramana Maharshi came out with that statement, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it points to an inward change, right? That we, as we say in Unity many times, that we create our own reality in the sense that we change our mind and we change our world. In the book that you talk about, you change your mind, then you change your brain, and then you change your world or your life. And so it begins in consciousness, but it filters through this amazing but sometimes problematic instrument called our brains. And one of the things I like about the book is you go into some detail in terms of brain structure and how it links in with not just neuropsychology, but also spiritual psychology. So in terms of, the way that flow works, mind to brain to to our lives, to our outer manifestation. Yeah. Talk about that a little more.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, the way we feel in any moment, I mean, the sounds people are hearing right now, the sensations in their body, let's say they're sitting or walking or driving a car, whatever it is, all of that, including very subtle experiences, are constructed through the nervous system. There's not much question about that in science, and so that means that things that happen in the nervous system change the way we feel. You know, if you don't have enough of certain key neurotransmitters like serotonin, naturally you get depressed. If, on the other hand, you, over time, build up, literally, neural tissues that have to do with, let's say, mindful attention or self-awareness, you then become more self-aware and more mindfully attentive. So as your brain changes, you know, what you experience changes. The great news is that thought alone, because of what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity, in other words, thought is information that's being represented in and communicated by and operated upon the nervous system, but the thoughts that we have, which then have a one-to-one mapping to underlying neural activities, those thoughts change the structure of the brain as they pass through the nervous system, for better or worse. In other words, if you dwell on the negative, your brain will take the shape over time of the negative. On the other hand, if you dwell on things that are positive, and also if you focus on building up certain skills in small daily ways, then you will gradually change your brain for the better. And at a time when so many of us, just to key off of where you started here, feel so pushed around by large-scale factors, it's great to feel that at least there's some place where you've got some influence, some place where you're a hammer instead of a nail, which is to say, inside your own head.
Yes, very good. I had a person on the show last week, Dr. Tom Zander. He's a former CEO of Unity and chief executive officer of many big corporations. He's talking about God goes to work and how to apply spiritual principles to your life. Talked about mental roadways or neural pathways, that we can recreate these pathways, right? That it takes effort to change habits, but it's not impossible. You can begin to go down different routes in your brain, right? You can reframe your awareness, I guess, so, and therefore change how you look at things. This is huge, isn't it, in terms of applying this awareness that we're talking about?
Yeah, and I think, a little bit, partly because I'm so in the world of neuroscience, I think it's helpful to take it with a grain of salt and appreciate that, much as you well know, and your listeners do too, there's been a long history that stretches, I think, way past the time that history began, with writing 5,000 years ago. I mean, there's a long story in humankind where people very legitimately did different things to change their mind, right? What's new is that we're starting to get more and more clear about how that happens inside the black box of the brain. And that creates opportunities because, for one, it is motivating, to take your point, that you can know that what you're doing really does make physical changes in your brain, and studies with MRI pictures and so forth are revealing that. But what's also useful is to grab hold of what neuroscience is finding with some specificity and zero in on key neural circuits. Or, for example, study the brains of people who are quite evolved, let's say long-term meditation practitioners, or we can choose other groups if we wanted to. Study what's going on inside the brains of people that are really good at happiness, love, and wisdom, let's say, and then do the reverse engineering. By understanding what's happening in their brains, we can then use the mind alone to stimulate those same neural networks. And by stimulating them, strengthen them. Because in the famous saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together. So if we get those circuits of wholesome states of mind firing together, we then are wiring and strengthening those circuits through our practice.
Do we know intuitively, do you think, what the right thing to do is?
That's a deep question, John. Paul, rather. I went to your middle name there. I want to say the sentimental part of me, you know, wants to say yes. And yet I've also been a therapist one way or another for about 35 years. And I'm just thinking about people who truly, who don't know the right thing to do. But then the more spiritual part of me really thinks that, you know, I think particularly just about everybody, if they just sit quietly, literally for a few minutes and open up to, if they're able to, open up to themselves in a deep way, usually there is that so-called still, quiet voice of conscience or inner knowing or truth or the spark of the divine within, let's say even, that does know what to do. So I hope I'm not trying to straddle too many fences here. I think at the end of my journey of my answer, my response to you, I would say yes.
Yeah.
Most of the time, at least.
Well, I think we don't trust us.
I have known what I need to do.
Yeah, I think there's a sense that we override that intuitive awareness with later developments, you know, with that doubting mind. And we sort of have to, as the Sufis say, learn how to unlearn, you know, to come back to that...
Yeah.
The more pristine place, you know, that you reference Zen and other traditions, and of course mindfulness traditions, you know, which talk often about the natural mind, you know, going back to our essential nature. You have an interesting statement in the book. You say that we have Velcro, or the brain is Velcro mm-hmm. for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And I've heard this before, that we're sort of wired for pessimism, and maybe that's so that we can survive, you know, that we're always looking out for the enemy. But as we progress in society, that becomes a hampering thing when we're always looking pessimistically at things. So talk about that, and how can we overcome that? How can we shift that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer that kind of in two quick parts. The first part references what you just brought up about what gets in the way of that inner knowing that's so important. And I think part of what gets in the way of it is that people's minds are just clouded with busyness and distractions and worries and tasks. We did not even, you know, we evolved as hunter-gatherers who basically wandered through the grasslands and the edges of the forests in Africa. And, you know, life was harsh often, but it was simple, you know, and it progressed at the pace of a walk, you know, in rhythm with the seasons, et cetera. And today, we just flood our minds, most of us, certainly in the West, in industrial democracies, we flood our minds with so much stuff, it's particularly hard to know what's really true. That's part one. And then part two, yeah, I think the mind, based on the default setting in evolution, as well as other factors, which we'll go into in a second, does tend toward the negative. You know, let's say you have a relationship with somebody you live with or work with or sleep with, and 20 things happen in a day with that person, you know, 10 are positive, 9 are neutral, and 1's negative. What's the one you think about as you're falling asleep at night, right?
Yes.
It's the one negative thing, yeah. So quick answer here about the Velcro for the negative experiences. You know, as we evolved in terms of biological evolution, distinct from spiritual evolution or cultural evolution, as we evolved biologically, yes, it was important for animals to get carrots, but it was much more important to avoid sticks, because if you don't get a carrot today, you'll have a chance of one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. That's why we have internalized, for example, a real focus on negative experiences. They trump the positive. You know, research on couples has found that long-term happy couples need to have at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive experiences to negative ones, implying that one negative experience is at least as powerful as 5 positive ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very easy to train people in helplessness, to give them a sense of futility and hopelessness and helplessness. And it takes a lot of unlearning to move out of that sense of helplessness into a sense of efficacy. As you say, very clearly, you know, that was adaptive for pure survival, but it's lousy for quality of life. And arguably, it's not adaptive for survival any longer when we're living on a planet with pushing 7 billion people, and we're so intertwined with each other, as opposed to the days when we evolved as fairly isolated hunter-gatherer bands that kind of bumped into each other from time to time, but pretty much, you know, lived in their own world. And so the how to do it, what to do about it, I think there's several things. I mean, I have a whole chapter, for example, on one big thing, which for me is the importance of taking in the good and defeating the bias of the brain, which immediately remembers and stores negative experiences. It may forget the episode, but it recalls the experience, the feeling, you know. But it doesn't immediately store positive experiences unless we really, really register them and savor them. That's why I think it's so important when you're having a positive experience, including most, and most positive experiences are mild. But when you're having a positive experience, even a mild one, because that's what most of them are, really stay with it, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row to force that experience to get woven into the fabric of your brain and yourself. Get those neurons firing together, you know, so they wire together and they stitch that resource into your being.
And, I think part of the difficulty, too, is groupthink, or as we might call it in Unity, sort of collective or race consciousness, you know, that we tend to buy into the nature of the group, which sometimes is at a more primitive level. You know, I think nation states, for instance, are acting on a more primitive level than some of the citizens within those states. So we end up with, you know, a huge military system, even though many people think, well, we've moved beyond that. But it's hard to change that, isn't it? And I think that's why it's so important, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, the Sangha, in the Western tradition, of the idea of community, people of like mind gathering together to make a difference, to support each other in a new paradigm, if you like, a new way of looking at things. It's so important here.
You know, I totally agree. I think of two things. One, you know, as we evolved on the Serengeti, exile was a death sentence. You know, you could not live outside of community, literally. And then I also think of the AA saying, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood, never go in alone.
And
even in Buddhism, for example, just to use that as an illustration of the point, and then people can judge its merits on their own, you know, as the Buddha famously said, when his close attendant, Ananda, said that community was half of the spiritual life, half of the holy life, the Buddha said, not so, Ananda, not so. It's the whole of the holy life, because it's the foundation that enables the rest of it to occur.
Very good. All right, hold that thought. I'm with Rick Hansen. We're talking about his book, which he co-wrote with Richard Mendius, on the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom. Buddha's brain, and we could quite easily say the Christ brain as well, I think it would fit.
Yeah.
All right, join us again in a couple of minutes after these messages from Unity.
You are listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. To support this ministry, go to www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Your contribution helps us broadcast messages of love and inspiration throughout the world.
Many people, like myself, desire more out of life. I want more out of my work, my daily interactions, and my relationships, including my connection with the divine. So when I found Unity House's new book by the Reverend Dr. Thomas Shepherd called Good Questions, a lot of things started making sense.
Dear Tom, how can I believe in the integrity of God if I can't believe in my own integrity? From K.A. in Iowa. Dear K.A., God's goodness is independent of your highs and lows, but lighten up on yourself, my friend. Everybody has gloomy spells in their moral and spiritual life. Everyone makes mistakes. Self-doubt is endemic to the species Homo sapiens. People tend to doubt themselves and to be their own worst critics. All people fall short of their goals. In fact, that's one of the classic definitions of sin. But making mistakes, even really, really bad ones, does not define who you are. You are Imago Dei, the spiritual image and likeness of God. The divine spirit within is your true identity, now and forever.
Dr. Tom's an expert in metaphysical Christianity who is sometimes passionate, sometimes funny, but always ready to tackle the agonizing questions about life and our spiritual path. His book, Good Questions, Answering Letters from the Edge of Doubt, is a must-read for those of us who listen to his show here on Unity FM or read his column in Unity Magazine. Get your copy today online at unity.org and click on the shop link.
Sometimes people tell me they've been studying spiritual principles for years, and I've got one question for them. How's your life working? How do you apply principle in every decision, every day? Hi, this is Reverend Ellen Debenport, and that's what Laura Shepherd and I talk about every week on Absolute Living, here on Unity Online Radio. How do we consciously create our experiences in life? What are we attracting, and how can we change it? How do we live at the highest levels of consciousness? On Absolute Living, we talk about how spiritual laws can be used in health, relationships, work, family, prosperity, even parenting. We look at current events for evidence of the laws in action. And we admit our own fears and failures. Laura and I don't live in higher consciousness all the time. But join us on Absolute Living. It's live on Mondays at 1 p.m. Central or in the archives anytime.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to our show today. I'm talking with Rick Hansen on about his book, Buddha's Brain, and as we referenced in the first segment, it could also be called the Christ Brain, in the sense that we're talking about that higher awareness that's summarized by those phrases, Christ or Buddha or Enlightened One. The next stage of development, perhaps, for our species to reach that Christed consciousness or that Buddha awareness, part and parcel of our evolutionary unfoldment, perhaps. Is that okay with you, Rick, that we could substitute Christ?
It depends on how the word is meant, and for me, the distinction is actually important, not just semantic. It's simply that some people would think of the Christ brain, if you will, as really, in fundamental ways, dependent upon divine influence. And
right.
Whereas Buddha's brain, in the Buddhist framework, he was not implying or accounting for divine influence. And so he, in a sense, was doing, he was working within what is consistent with, you know, modern, you know, sort of Western views of, you know, doing mental training alone, making a change for you. And by mental training, I mean that very broadly. You know, he trained his heart and body as well as his mind, of course. You
right.
know, and it's just because of that, and out of respect for people who are Christian who might take issue with reducing, potentially, in their mind at least, reducing Christianity to the operation of just a material brain itself. You know, I deliberately did not use that kind of language.
Yes, okay. Well, and I'm coming from sort of a more unitive point of view, you know,
yeah.
movement,
yeah.
which is a little different from more traditional Christianity, I guess, in the sense we're more aligned with Eastern concepts, you know, around
yeah.
that. And so we would probably find it interchangeable. But, yeah, for a more
yeah.
traditional theology, you know, in terms of Christianity, it probably would not be acceptable. Let's talk a little bit about empathy, because you mentioned in the notes that I received from you recently that you said our President Obama exhibits a lot of empathy and talks a lot about empathy and how important empathy is in terms of spiritual wisdom and moving beyond dualism. Talk more about that, because that's a fascinating subject.
Okay, sure. I think empathy is critically important. Again, going to the frame we began with, which looks at the world in trouble. And part of it is that, you know, when we were hunter-gatherers, that needed to have empathy within the band, but needed to survive in part by not having empathy for people outside the band, because there was historically a lot of conflict for scarce resources between hunter-gatherer bands. So in the Native American metaphor, I think are two wolves, you know, one of love and one of hate, and everything depends on which one we feed every day, you know. But these days, when we're jostling up against each other and we're all living in just one lifeboat, planet Earth, right? If we don't have empathy for the other people who are pulling on oars or bailing or jumping up and down on the boat because their needs are not being met and they're starving to death, for example, and if we don't have empathy for them, we're all going to sink together. So it's in that context that I think it's great that you're bringing this topic up. What is empathy? Empathy basically means that we're simulating, in effect, inside ourselves, the inner world of another person. And there are different neural networks in the brain that accomplish that, which I'll skip over. I talk about them in the book. But the implication is that you can do things, if you want to build up those neural networks inside yourself. For example, just one illustration, if you tune more into your own body through mindfulness of breathing, meditation, or tuning into your body during Pilates or yoga or golfing, what have you, or walking the dog every day, if you really do that, you build up a part of the brain called the insula, and the neural circuits in the insula also are involved with empathy for the emotions of others. So the nice thing here is that by building up your own self-awareness, particularly for your own body, you can become more empathic, more resonant with, more attuned to other people. So that's good. And it illustrates the larger point that we can do things to become more empathic toward other people. And frankly, empathy is a topic that can be negotiated in couples. And in my own mind, much as it's appropriate, you know, or in principle, to be able to negotiate how people load the dishwasher, you know, it's also appropriate to negotiate their willingness to truly give their attention to the other person, to really open to the other person, and to, you know, try to become more empathic and to express themselves more empathically. I mean, for me, those are legitimate topics to negotiate. One has to do it skillfully rather than unskillfully, obviously. I speak as a guy who's pushing 30 years of marriage here and has definitely been unskillful from time to time and paid the price. Anyway, my point is that empathy is something that is not just a given. You're not just stuck with however much empathy you have, but it's actually a faculty, call it a skill even, that's really developable.
Well, and you know, it's one of those subjects that is easily mocked by others, you know, that we are, and perhaps that's a good thing. We have a very finely tuned antenna as to which is authentic empathy and which isn't. You know, I know President Clinton, for instance, was mocked many times for saying, you know, I feel your pain and all that. It even though, you know, it was a good thing in a sense, it opened him up for pot shots, and I think this is true about empathy. You know, if we're too touchy feely, you know, we can go too far in that direction, and there's a balance here. And you talk a lot about balance in the book. You know, it's not a question of going into that overly empathetic side of ourselves. You know, Jesus, of course, brilliantly summed it up when he said to be innocent as doves and wise as serpents. You know, it's a very Buddhist statement, isn't it?
Can you say that again, Paul?
Be innocent as doves and wise as serpents. You know, that balance, you know, be empathetic, but also be screwed down tight into reality. Uh-huh. And that's another thing you mentioned in terms of how to, you know, move skillfully here is be realistic. You know, we don't want to be idealistic or soft in that sense. We want to have the cunning of the serpent, but also the innocence of the dove. It's an interesting balance there, sort of paradoxical balance.
That's that's great. You know, like, for example, I have great respect for Jesus. I mean, if respect is probably too small a word even, and it's a great metaphor. Yeah, well, a couple points here. First of all, being empathic, people often think that somehow it means agreement or you're waiving your own rights. And yeah, it's absolutely not. And also, it's important to appreciate that empathy is morally neutral. For example, you know, think about the interrogation cells in Guantanamo, let alone in, you know, North Korea or Saudi Arabia or Iran and or Russia these days, you know, or anywhere in the world, right? You know, people who are autistic and lack empathy would make terrible interrogators or torturers because or serial killers, because they don't have, you know, empathy for the suffering of their victims. So my point is that being empathic is actually a great way to understand your adversaries and to gather important information that enables you to assert yourself more skillfully against them, right? Or to build up allies to deal with them, because you understand them more deeply. Also, empathy is enormously useful in daily life, whether you're just dealing with, you know, your prospects as a salesperson, or, you know, coworkers on the job, or raising kids, or, you know, navigating life with a partner. Empathy is a deep part of that. And I think Obama, in my own view, you know, has used his empathy for both people in the Arab world as well as his empathy for what's happening here in America for people who may not agree with him politically and yet have been, you know, really hurt by the economic consequences of, you know, the previous administration prior to Obama. You know, he's used that empathy, I think, to help bridge divides that, you know, are long overdue in terms of bridging.
Yes. You know, I was at a wedding.
My two cents. Not trying to pontificate, but that's definitely my two cents.
That's okay. You know. You pontificate on this show, no problem.
Okay. I think empathy is tough-minded. Do you mind if I rant briefly? It's really fast.
Go ahead,
it's just I think there are all kinds of virtues that have been, you know, relegated to this sort of box of New Age, woo-woo, West Coast, airy-fairy, wooshy, dare I use the charged word, feminine virtues that are actually, you know, for one, they're not the monopoly of males or females, but for two, they're absolutely critical to being resilient and being strong and, you know, making this world a better place and sticking up for your loved ones and those you care about. And they're absolutely critical to long-term resilience and mental health. And they're hard won. You know, you don't just go to Esalen for a weekend and acquire a deep capacity for empathy, because for, among other things, you've got to be able to stand strong while you're present with another person's views, pains, blame, sorrow, etc. You know, you need to have deep roots to be able to be truly empathic. You know, fences make for good neighbors, as they say. You know, having a strong sense of your own autonomy is really what allows us to enter into intimacy. So, you know, I've done a lot of business consulting. I've been in the real world here, not an ivory tower guy. I've seen lots of people who talk tough, you know, in business or kind of macho posturing, if you will, male or female, mostly male, unfortunately, but anyway. And yet, when it comes down to, you know, the strength it takes to sustain openness to others, or the strength it takes to be internally empathic to your own interior, they don't have that kind of courage. They don't have those, if I may say it on the radio, you know, I won't say it actually, but if they don't have the jewels, if you follow my drift, to do that thing, you know, the family jewels to do that thing, they just don't do it. And I think, come on, that's where real strength is.
Right. Well, I was just talking with somebody the other day about a man. He just passed on. I did his funeral, and he did so many things, you know, in so many civic organizations, so many activities, sports, traveling, and et cetera. But, you know, everything was very outer-oriented, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think there's, you know, there's another kind of person who has a sort of a very rich interior life. So we can have just as rich a life on that inner exploration. And you mentioned that at the beginning of the book, you know, that those who contemplate and those who dedicate their lives to meditation, you know, Olympic athletes of the brain and soul and mind. And, you know, just as valid as outer-oriented. And our society gives great credence, of course, to outer-oriented things and less so, perhaps, to inner awareness. And I just wanted to point out, I was doing a wedding recently, and one of the groomsmen was a Marine. And I asked him, you know, what do you think of Obama? And he said, well, I come from a very conservative background, and most of the, you know, the service is more conservative than parts other parts of the country. But he said, you know, I think Obama's done well, and I don't have any problem with him in militarily, and unlike Michelle Obama, you know, she has a lot of empathy. And I thought, this is coming from, you know, a U.S. Marine, and that was encouraging, you know, that there can be that understanding that, yeah, it's okay to have that empathetic approach, you know, and still be, you know, gung-ho military-type person. So you know, because I think that's what it's about, isn't it? It's not about them and us. You quote another phrase in the book, nothing left out, and we could also say nobody left out. We're all in this together, correct?
Yes. That's completely true. including, you know, and to push it a little bit again, I've been, you know, I'm in California, and I teach around a lot of places, and very often, particularly if you're working in a mental health environment, you know, teaching to therapists, or in an environment where people are interested in things like mindfulness, you know, often the politics is fairly liberal. Certainly, the center mass of the distribution is there, and bringing up people like Dick Cheney, you know, or George Bush, or you know, Karl Rove or John Boehner, what have you, you know, right there, wham! Suddenly, now a lot of people in the room who are deep in compassion and loving kindness a few moments before suddenly have lost all capacity, you know, for empathy and goodwill, you know, for those people. So, you know, I think the wolf of hate is alive and well in everyone, in almost everyone's heart. I think there are a few rare beings within whom literally there is no wolf of hate. But most of us, certainly me, you know, have that wolf of hate. And if we don't take responsibility for it, and if we don't keep our eyes clearly open about it, you know, if we don't, you know, use the wisdom of the serpent, if you will, to discern the wolf of hate inside ourselves, you know, then we create trouble for ourselves and others.
Yeah, I agree. I've been ministering in the one church now for 23 years, and, you know, and wonderful things have happened, but I'm also amazed at how we cling to ego still, you know, even in a spiritual community. And sometimes spiritual communities can be the worst for that, you know, because we kind of spiritualize our ego and then think it's okay, you know. That's one of the greatest barriers, isn't it, on the spiritual path is, you know, having a spiritualized sense of self. And it can be really problematic, I think. You talk about...
Yeah, I think that's really true.
You talk about, you know, changing sense of self. It's hard to pin down who we actually are, that the reality of us is much more spacious than we... allow ourselves to be at most times. We're going up to the second break. I want to ask a quick question. The Buddhists talk a lot about taking refuge, you know, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Isn't that just hiding? You're taking refuge. You're hiding away.
You're setting up a provocative thing before the break. Okay.
1 minute to answer that, Rick.
All right. You mean right now or just before or after the break?
You got 1 minute before the break.
Okay, my super short answer, we can go later, is, hey, we all need wellsprings. We all need to rely upon things that feed us and protect us and serve us. And so, you know, it's not a cop-out to take refuge in things. It's actually enlightened self-interest and the kindest thing you can do to others. And it's humble. You know, to me, it's deeply arrogant and so American in our culture to think that we could make our way in the world as a rugged individualist. But the truth is, we're profoundly dependent upon streams of causes. The question is, are we taking refuge in crummy causes, or are we taking refuge in wholesome ones?
Yeah, it's very good. Good distinction. Because, you know, so often we rely on alcohol or drugs or shopping or food or whatever. You know, we take refuge in those rather unhealthy things. At the very moment I said that, our engineer just took a bagel into his mouth. So everything's in good. It's some Twizzler type thing. Everything's in divine order here. Wonderful.
All right, good. Or disorder.
But you know, you're right. We need to have healthful ways of taking refuge, right? Which provides stability and strength, so we can show up in a more integrated and ennobled way. All right, I'm with
Absolutely.
Rick Hansen here. We're talking about his fascinating book, Buddha's Brain. Get a hold of it if you can. I'll give you the links later in the show. We're going to take a break, listen to these messages, and come back in a few minutes for our third segment.
He's the most talked about figure in history. How do you see Jesus? As a savior? A way shower, a mythical hero. In his cutting-edge new book, Jesus 2.1, An Upgrade for the 21st Century, Reverend Dr. Thomas Shepherd explores the many human concepts of Jesus.
The man of Nazareth has been an imaginary spiritual playmate for millions. Best friend, confidant, silent lover, surrogate father, brother, husband, trusted king when earthly governments fail, all-purpose superhero who will save the day before the final credits roll. Jesus is like a program, that has been adapted through the ages while the basic code remains undisturbed despite all subsequent modifications. Now it is our time to rewrite and reinstall the Jesus program with updates for today, just as every previous generation has done and every subsequent generation will do. The Romans killed Jesus for being a revolutionary. Every succeeding generation kills him anew by losing sight of the ongoing revolution in human consciousness that he represents.
Explore the new book, Jesus 2.1, at www.shopunity.org.
Are you searching for some levity and humor on your spiritual path? Then join us for Unity Happy Hour with your hosts, Reverend Ogun Holder and Ted Collins, Dean of Unity Institute and Vice President of Education and Retreats at Unity Village. Each week, Reverend Ogun and Dean Ted will have spirited, humorous, and somewhat irreverent discussions about current events, family, culture, and really anything under the sun, set against a backdrop of spirituality and personal growth. So bring your authentic self and join us Mondays at noon Central, right here on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Now back to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to our show. We're in the third segment. I'm talking with Rick Hansen on his book, Buddha's Brain. He's been on the show before, and the reason he's back is not just because he has to be back, but also because there's so much in this book that's worthy of analysis, and I like the way it combines the neuroscientific side to the mindfulness spiritual side into a seamless whole, which of course is what we've been talking about, that it's a question of balance and integration here. And one thing I want to ask you, Rick, since the book's come out, you know, your thinking been changed, or how has the book been received? You know, just tell us a little bit about your experience with this journey.
Oh, sure. Briefly, the book's been received amazingly well. My very first book was about how to take good care of mothers over the long haul, and couples, too, after they have kids. It was called Mother Nurture. Penguin published it in 2002, 6 months after 9/11, and the book went nowhere. So I've experienced that kind of book. This is my second book, Buddha's Brain, and it's gone somewhere. It's still doing very, very well, and I get incredibly heartened by the lovely emails I get or comments I get from people about it. And I think it's done well because, honestly, it's so practical. I mean, it's grounded in science, it's legit, and it's grounded in my own legit, I think, contemplative training. But it's relentlessly useful for daily life, you know, and I think that's what people like about it because, you know, I've read a lot of books about the world and new thought and science of mind and also neuropsychology, and most of them are not very useful. So this one was really useful. What's added since I wrote it over 2 years ago, it's been out about a year and 9 months now, is that I've come to appreciate really more what you talked about earlier, the quoting Zen, you know, natural state of the mind, natural mind. And I've come to appreciate that the brain has its own natural state, which is good news. You know, in a quick nutshell, in terms of three fundamental motivational systems in the brain, you could say the reptilian, the mammalian, and the primate systems that in order avoid harm, approach reward, and attach to us, right? Avoid, approach, attach. In terms of those three systems, the brain operates in two modes, responsive or reactive. And the default setting of the brain is good. It's the responsive mode in which the avoiding system defaults to a state of calm when it doesn't feel threatened. The approaching system defaults to a state of contentment when it feels fulfilled and not frustrated or disappointed. And the attaching system defaults to a state of caring, you know, when it doesn't feel rejected or abandoned or alone. That's the good news. The problem is the brain also evolved hair trigger mechanisms that drive us from home, as it were, into the reactive mode, you know, of basically hatred, greed, and heartache. You know, and those who know Buddhism will recognize the two traditional poisons of greed and hatred. And I'm naming a third that's implicit in what the Buddha taught, the poison of heartache, when the attaching system is disturbed. to me, the point is to take the fruit as the path. And that's shorthand for a Tibetan saying in which we take the goal of practice, which broadly defined is calm, contentment, and caring, I think, in one word or another, with wisdom rather than ignorance woven throughout. We basically take those fruits as how we live our lives day to day. In other words, every second, literally, certainly every minute, that we are resting in the natural state of the brain and therefore the mind, this responsive mode of calm, contentment, and caring, every minute we rest there, we strengthen the neural substrates of there, because neurons that fire together wire together. Every time we stimulate those neural substrates, we make them stronger. And so for me, that's been a very strong, very important organizing framework over the last couple of years, and I'll weave it into my next book. I actually have another book coming out in October called Just One Thing, which is a book of practices, very specific, simple things people can do, which relates to this newsletter, this little short weekly e-newsletter I do that now has 23,000 subscribers, which has blown my mind.
Wow.
It's about practice, but the one after that will most likely be about taking in the good, and will refer to the importance of trusting in the good, turning to the good, taking refuge in the good, having faith in the good that's in our own heart, in the heart of others, and in the world, and the good possibilities for the future, and taking a stand against the so prevalent meme these days on both the right and the left of, quote-unquote, these dark times, as if we're all doomed and might as well just give up and gaze at our navel or engage in bread and circuses.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, there we go. Gaze at our, nice way to put it. Gaze at our navels or indulge in the bread and circuses. And you know, neither way is really satisfactory. The one leads
right.
to a sort of otherworldly spirituality, and the one leads to sort of an immersion in trying to find satisfaction in that which is ultimately unsatisfactory. And so we lose all kinds of balance. And by the way, I liked what you said. There's a difference between equanimity, which is one of the four immeasurable qualities of the Buddha, and calm. You know, we tend to see them as synonymous sometimes, equanimity and calm, but there is a difference. Tell us about that.
Oh, simply, basically, if you're calm, you're not having any reactions. If you're equanimous, you're not reacting to your reactions. And what I mean by that, kind of quickly, is that at any moment in time, continually in the mind, we're having pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral reactions to things. In Western psychology, that's called the hedonic tone. In Buddhism, it's called the feeling tone. It's not emotional. It's more, you know, a sense of is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Anyway, that's a great way to get, you know, animals to, right, chase after the pleasant and avoid and run from or fight against the unpleasant. But on the other hand, if we're continually reacting to the hedonic tone, to the feeling tone, that generates in the Buddhist model, you know, craving, clinging, and then suffering. The trick is to install a kind of shock absorber in which you allow things to be pleasant and you like what's pleasant. You allow things to be unpleasant as they are. Obviously, try to minimize that, but there's an irreducible minimum, isn't there, in life of uncomfortable experiences, physical and emotional. So you allow them to be unpleasant and you allow yourself to dislike them without tipping over into massive wanting, you know, without getting into driving toward having more and more and more and more, more, you know, pleasant experiences, or going to war with those unpleasant experiences. And that distinction between liking and wanting, right, between allowing these experiences to arrive and then getting reactive about them, that distinction right there is honestly, I think, right at the heart of practical day-to-day wisdom.
You know, and Jesus talked about it in terms of turning the other cheek, which is one of the most misunderstood phrases, I think, in the whole of Scripture. You know, that idea that, you know, it seems passive. It seems like we become victims, and I don't think he was referring to that. He was referring to a sense of great, deep, abiding peace, you know, that comes when we neither go one way or the other. We, like you say, it's not a question of giving up anything. It's a question of allowing greater space to be present, maybe, for what is. So therefore, we embrace others and instead of seeing them as opposing us or a danger to us. And therefore, we confound them, don't we, in the sense that we confound ourselves, our own our old habits of separation dissolve in that equanimity, and compassion and embrace arises. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think, and also, which is consistent with what you're saying, it takes great strength to turn the other cheek, and it also is a communication to the other who has struck you that you're not afraid and you're not beaten. And if fear may arise, you're not dominated by that fear. You're not beaten by it. And that is a very strong statement of strength. It takes strength, obviously, to do that. And also, it promotes self-respect. I mean, I think it's very important also to distinguish, as I'm sure you do, between the strength of, you know, nonviolent protest, if you will, or the strength of, you know, basically saying to someone, you have my body, sure, you can hit my other cheek if you want, but you cannot take my mind. Let's distinguish between that strength and obviously people who are too passive when they're being mistreated or too passive about the mistreatment of others.
Yes, excellently put. Okay, in the last 5 minutes, if you have something you'd like to share with our listeners that could be of practical effect to them, what would that be? A kernel of this
sure.
book?
Okay, sure. Thank you for your graciousness here. Well, first I would just say, if people want my website, they can get through buddhasbrain.com. And then if they go, both the website itself is full of practices. It's full of freely offered practical things people can do in the form of all these talks I've given, articles I've written, and the slide sets, the PowerPoint slide sets for all these workshops I've given, which really cut to the chase, you know. Also at that website, they can get to the practices in the Just One Thing newsletter. If they want, they can sign up for it as well. I never share people's email addresses, and you can always unsubscribe. I'm a big privacy advocate. Anyway, so there are lots of practices there. Out of the whole kit and caboodle, the one I'll maybe leave your listeners with is the practice of taking in the good. There are three steps. You can do it right now. I'll walk you through it real fast. Step one, you know, allow good facts to become good experiences. That means you've got to see the good facts in your life. This is, by the way, not about rose-colored glasses or positive thinking. It's about seeing good facts and then letting the needle move so you feel it, allowing yourself to start having a positive experience based on a positive fact. Second step is to savor it, is to stay with it 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. Defeat the negativity bias, get those neurons to fire together so they wire together, weaving that positive experience into your own mind, into your brain, and therefore your being. And then in the third step, you activate memory systems by just sensing and intending that this positive experience is sinking into you, like water into a sponge, or if I'm talking with kids, like a jewel into the treasure chest of the heart. And that little practice, on any given moment you do it, will probably not change your life. But the accumulation, half a dozen or more times a day, just on the fly, you know, as things happen, or at certain moments, sacred moments, maybe upon waking, at meals, or maybe just before bed, or at the end of, let's say, a time of practice, formal practice of prayer or contemplation or meditation, if you do that within days, if not weeks, you'll definitely feel a difference.
Excellent.
So it's one of my favorite practices, and I've been doing it all my life. And I'll say one last little thing about it. If you happen to know what your own particular vitamin C is that you need, in other words, what was missing in your childhood, or where were you wounded, or what's been missing in your life altogether, if you know what really you long for to fill that particular individual hole in your own heart, then you can go looking for that vitamin C, as it were, out there in the world, and then deliberately take it in, you know, a few times a day, internalizing it, so you gradually fill the hole in your heart.
Excellent. All right, wonderful way to end our show. I want to thank Rick Hansen so much for being with us again. Get a hold of this book. Go on the sites if you want to. Find out more about Rick and the work he does. Next week we have Psalms in Ordinary Voices. They're reworkings of the Psalms by ordinary folks, men, women, and children, and they've been compiled in a book with beautiful photographs. I'll be talking with the authors of that next week, so join me then. And again, thanks, Rick. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. This is always great talking with you, Paul.
Yeah, I appreciate you very much, and the book is wonderful. I'm going to reread it again for the third time now because there's so much in it that's worthy and worthwhile. So thanks, everyone, for listening to Unity FM. If you love the show and you like other shows, consider clicking the contribute button, the donate button to keep us on the air. And again, we are the voice of an awakening world. making a difference, as so many other voices are, to bring these unitive ideas into practical effect in our lives. All right, take care now and join me next week.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world, and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
You have a good life and are grateful for it. But what if you stretched beyond good and shifted to amazing? Join Reverend Temple Hayes, senior minister of the First Unity Campus in St. Petersburg, Florida, as she guides you on a journey to an amazing life. Transcend the need for acceptance of others and be an example of living the truth. Empower your life and fully express the wondrous energy, love, and joy you hold in your wildest imagining. Joyfully and actively know that more important than what happens after you die is the deeper and enriching concern for what happens while you're living. How can you experience an amazing life right now? Learn how each week on From Good to Amazing. Mondays at 4 p.m. Central Time, right here on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Things may happen around you, things may happen to you, but the only things that really count are the things that happen in you.
This meditative moment from Reverend Eric Butterworth is brought to you by Unity.
The Unity message is universal, uniting, empowering, and transformational. Carrying this message to the world with the power of music and song are scores of singers and songwriters who dedicate their extraordinary gifts to helping heal the world and spread the message of unity and oneness. These are the messengers of unity.
We salute the messengers of unity. The voices of the one voice of all humanity. Heroes with weapons of melody and rhyme, waging peace one song at a time.
Tune in to Pazapalooza, Music That Matters, with host Richard McDeasy, to hear the music and the artists who are changing the world one song at a time. Fridays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world.
Even if you're a seasoned spiritual student, even if you've been on a spiritual journey for a long time, how's your life working? Knowing spiritual principles isn't enough. We have to practice them every day. Join Reverend Ellen Debenport and co-host Laura Shepherd on Absolute Living as they talk each week about putting principles into action in every decision we make.